Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Oshman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 206. Practical isn't the point. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And before we jump back into our continuing series on Yiddish in America, a short update on our Kickstarter campaign to publish our first book, Judaism Unbound Bound, which will be a collection of conversations that we've had over the first 4 years of the podcast that are fundamental to our point of view and that really start to get at this shape of what we've been calling, thanks to Yitz Greenberg, the third era of Judaism. We are so excited to say that we have already reached the minimum goal for the Kickstarter to allow the book to go forward. Now, we still have the campaign going for another 2.5 weeks, and we've established some stretch goals. And if we achieve those stretch goals, it's going to allow us to put more pages in the book, which means more conversations. And it's also going to allow us to invest in the design of the book to make it not only more beautiful, but also more usable in all kinds of ways that we are thinking about and that we've been talking to designers about. And additional funding beyond that is also going to be used on this book project to transcribe more episodes, to start planning future books. We have ideas about volume 2. And I would just add, the most funded Jewish publishing project on Kickstarter ever was $20,000. We're about halfway there. So I promise you that we are not taking any fancy vacations with this money. We are using it to share Judaism Unbound in new ways with you. And with people who don't listen to podcasts, because there are so many of them who every time we talk about it, they say, oh, that would sound so interesting to me. I really wish that I could listen to that podcast, but I don't really listen to podcasts. So this is going to allow us to say, well, here's a book. Please help support this project. It's going to really amplify the voice of this podcast for all those people that are still using that old technology. Okay, Dan, you've convinced me, you say. So what do I do now? Well, it's really easy. Just go to www.judaismunbound.com/book, and that will take you directly to the Kickstarter page. And anybody who supports the project with $18 or more will get your name in the acknowledgments and get an ebook. And anybody who supports the project with $36 or more will get a physical copy of the book. And we're working on a bunch of other cool prizes to send along to people who order a print copy of the book as well. And now let's jump into our conversation for this series of episodes on Yiddish in America that we have put together with the Yiddish Book Center to celebrate their 40th anniversary and what they're calling the Decade of Discovery. Our guest today is Sandy Fox. She is a colleague in the world of Jewish podcasting, but her podcast is a feminist podcast in Yiddish. It's called Weiberteitsch, which literally means women's commentaries. And it was a term that their website calls the original mansplaining, commentaries that were written in Yiddish by men for women. But they're turning that on its head and having women commenting in women's own terms. Weiberteitsch describes itself as a platform for Yiddish speakers to create and consume new and exciting audio content in Yiddish. Its focus is to highlight the stories and works of women and queer folk and to discuss feminist issues. In addition to being the creator and host of Weiberteitsch, Sandy Fox is a historian of American Jewry. She has her PhD in Hebrew and Hebrew Judaic Studies from New York University, and she is now a Jim Joseph Postdoctoral Fellow in Education and Religion at Stanford University. She is working on a book about the lived experience and intergenerational tension in post-war American Jewish summer camps. Sandy Fox is on the editorial board of In Geveb, a Journal of Jewish Studies. Sandy Fox, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm especially excited to have a fellow podcaster on who goes into the podcasting world with a feminist podcast in Yiddish and to get a sense from you about what is it that really sparked you to launch a podcast in Yiddish?
Yeah, well, I definitely didn't do it for fame or fortune. There's no money in Yiddish podcasting. There's very little money in Yiddish. But what did I say? I set out for making something for the Yiddish-speaking community. That's really it. I didn't have ambitions of talking to folks like you, although it's really great that I do. and that people are interested. But I had a very specific vision of making something in Yiddish that wasn't particularly about Yiddish for Yiddish speakers. There's a real lack of audio content and also audio video content, but that's not my purview, in Yiddish that's contemporary. And to me, feminism was just an obvious angle. I'm a feminist. I'm inspired by feminists in radio and podcasting, from the classics like Terry Gross to people that most people don't know, like Caitlin Prest, who makes who's made a podcast called The Heart for many years, and a CBC show called The Shadows. And that I thought feminism was a direction to take the podcast in that would make sure that it wouldn't become self-referential. I didn't want a podcast in Yiddish about Yiddish, but rather about people's lives, their work, their interests, their art, their music, their sexualities, whatever. I wanted that stuff to be talked about in Yiddish. So that was the kind of obvious direction to go in. So it's for them. And at the time that I started that, I started Vibratech in 2016, and at the time I thought a couple hundred people might be in that category of person, and I was wrong. People underestimate Yiddish all the time, the number of speakers, and I also underestimated it, thinking that maybe there were 1,000 of us non-Hasidic Yiddish speakers. It turns out there are many more.
Well, let's talk about who those are, because I'm thinking about my grandmother, who lived for many, many years in Boston. She was an immigrant from Lithuania. She's, you know, a native Yiddish speaker from her childhood. And there was this radio show, The Yiddish Hour, that she was often on. Still exists.
Yeah.
And so she was often a guest on The Yiddish Hour. And, you know, for her, this was her world. I mean, this was all these people that were like her that were out there listening to this. And I think that in my mind, it was like, well, that's who listens to Yiddish audio. You know, it's people who grew up speaking Yiddish in the old country and are here. And it's really part of, you know, who they are in this deep essence. And I guess I'm wondering, right, who's that audience today? Who are the Yiddish speakers today? How did they become Yiddish speakers? What's going on there?
Yeah. So, I mean, some of them are people like your grandma. Not many, because podcasts are not super accessible for older people. Some know how to use their phones better than others. And that's really unfortunate. It's one thing that I've really tried to figure out how to make it more accessible to that population, because they could be interested in this too. And I know some of them are. The Yiddish speakers who are listening to Vibratech range from people like me, non-heritage speakers who learned Yiddish maybe for academic reasons or maybe for personal reasons, and we can go into what those personal reasons are. They're heritage speakers, non-Hasidic heritage speakers. I'll get into Hasidim in a second. They also listen. So usually they're called Yiddishists, but they're basically from Yiddish enthusiast families, often the children of Yiddish teachers, Yiddish scholars, but not only. Then you have Hasidim, and there's no way for me to really know how many Hasidim are listening, but I do get emails from anonymous Hasidim. I see that Hasidim are talking about Vibratech once in a while on their online forums, like Kavishtibel, and I get attention from Hasidim on Instagram. That's the main way that Hasidim reach me, and it's very, very awesome to hear from them, usually men, which is fascinating. That's a lot of the range right there, is sort of like these quote-unquote secular Yiddishists, and I take issue with the term secular, because many of them are not secular, and the Hasidic community also.
I want to hear more on the you angle in addition to your audience. To me, it's not intuitive that one, given that you have an interest or somebody would have an interest in Yiddish, the idea of going the podcast route, for some of the reasons that you talked about, that podcasts aren't necessarily accessible to older people who are one of the demographic groups that is interested in Yiddish. Like, I'm curious the story there. Like, what led you down that path, and sort of emphasis on the you? Like, what was your journey growing up or in your studies as a scholar that led you towards Yiddish generally, but also towards somebody who is, you know, not just like communicating with people in Yiddish, but sort of part of this project of bringing Yiddish to others?
So my personal story is funny. I grew up in a Zionist youth movement. I grew up in Young Judea, and I was extremely involved. I went to Young Judea summer camp, year course. I was on national board of Young Judea. I had a very strong interest in Hebrew at a pretty young age. But there happened to be a bunch of these heritage Yiddishists in Young Judea with me, which is interesting, right? These worlds interact. Of course they do. There are no Yiddishist summer camps right now. So where else? Why? They might as well end up at the Zionist camp. So I never grew up with an impression like it was weird to like Yiddish, or that there was some tiny, I never thought it was a tiny minority of people who liked Yiddish and did stuff with Yiddish, because I knew a bunch of them. And as a kid, why would I know, you know, how unique that was? I just figured that was normal. And I started my PhD at NYU in 2012, originally studying Israel studies, and made a pivot in the first couple of years towards American Jewish history for a whole variety of reasons, but mostly all the projects I kept proposing to my Israel studies advisor had something to do with American youth and their relationship to Israel. And he kept just saying, maybe that's not Israel studies, you know, which we could argue about it, but I was really interested in working with Professor Hasia Diner as well. So I made that change, and Yiddish became an obvious place to go in terms of language acquisition. And NYU has a lot of language requirements. So I had to have academic Hebrew and another language. At the same time, my friend Naftali Edelman, who I met at Zionist summer camp as staff members, had just started Yiddish Farm, which is a farm in upstate New York where you can go and learn to farm while speaking and learning Yiddish and not being allowed to speak a word of any other language whatsoever. And he said, well, if you're going to learn Yiddish, you should come to my farm. I promise you, you can pass your exam in 2 weeks. I said, that sounds like a pretty good deal. And it sounds a lot like summer camp. So I went. I had the time of my life, and I fell in love with Yiddish. I don't know if that would have happened in an academic summer program. I guess we'll never know. But the ethos of the farm and the people who were there was really guided towards a sort of activist stance towards Yiddish, not just learning it and kind of passively being able to read it, but doing something with it. So I think very early on, the seeds were planted that I wasn't just going to learn Yiddish, but I was going to do something, whether that was write for the Vorwärts or the journal Offen Schwell, or make something of my own. So the first thing I did that's just kind of a joke is I made a YouTube video called Gettle Girls with my friend Sarah Knapp that was supposed to be like the HBO show Girls meets Yiddish Farm and reveal all of our like love problems on the farm, of which there were a lot. I don't think that's on YouTube anymore, but I'm certainly going to delete it now that I've mentioned it.
We're going to race you. We're going to see if it's there.
No. Well, I mean, it's in Yiddish. So it's in Yiddish. So it doesn't matter. In broken Yiddish, like early, early Yiddish for me. So that didn't really work. I'm not really a video person. And I just love podcasts and radio. I mean, I'm just a personal addict. Have been truly inspired by like this woman I mentioned before, Caitlin Press, whose audio work is really experimental and fabulous. And so this seemed kind of like the obvious path. And the feminist part came into it at a time, professional stuff, I started to notice the way that I and my female colleagues were treated in comparison to men. So I had a feminist, I guess, reawakening or redirecting. The Yiddishist world was also very male in its historical foundations, was very male and continued at that time to be, that a lot of the leaders in it were men. And the whole idea of legitimizing a language came from a sort of perspective of, let's not think of Yiddish as a mamalushin, as a woman's tongue, but rather as a legitimate and coded male language. So all of this came together to make Vibratech. And it's sort of every element of my background is, it kind of goes a long way to explain how it came to be.
I wanna sort of hold that, because that feels like there's many layers that just came together. So First off, you talked about growing up in Young Judea and the Zionist piece, and you just talked about the idea of like Yiddish being somehow feminine in the negative sense to those who see feminine as inferior to, you know, the real thing. And there's a bunch of pieces there that I'm going to try not to put all into this question, but I know myself and they'll all be there. Yeah. But one is these gender dynamics. I think that's so important. And I think that in the context of like the 20th century, where Zionism and Hebrew was so much this like muscular, masculine kind of project, Yiddish, I mean, I wasn't around at the time, but the sense I get is that Yiddish really was a kind of counter to that. And it was like what we don't want. And so I'm curious to hear from you, A, if that sense of mine historically is right about how people talked about Yiddish, how people related to Yiddish in comparison to other languages. And then I'm also really curious to open up the Pandora's box of what is real or authentic or legitimate. You use the word legitimate. When somebody says that Yiddish is or is not legitimate, or less legitimate than Hebrew, or more legitimate than, like, what's kind of happening there? How can we think about layers of authenticity as they relate to conversations about the Yiddish language?
Yeah, I'll start with the first thread. It's a little bit of a misunderstanding that Yiddishism and Zionism were completely diametrically opposed. I mean, they had oppositional elements, but I would say the Bund in Zionism were more opposed, and Yiddishism, there were some Yiddishists who also sympathized with Zionism. It's a more complicated category. But I do think that what you see in a lot of these nationalist movements, whether they're kind of linguistic nationalist or have an aspiration for a state like Zionism did, there is a certain element of masculinity. I mean, you mentioned in Zionism, there's this muscular Judaism idea, the chalutz ideal. And when people talk about women being equal in that movement, it's always framed as, well, that's because they became more like men. Yiddishism was really about, as well, this connects to the legitimacy question, was about making Yiddish into something that wasn't a derided jargon, put in quotes, a derided jargon, but rather a language that had rules and a uniform way of spelling, and that you would translate great works of literature into Yiddish. And those were ways in which usually men thought the path, sort of saw a path for Yiddish to become not only legitimate, but to be seen as the national language or a national language of the Jewish people. This was really a direct response to the derision that Yiddish received for being, quote, a language for women and men who act like women or feminine men, something like that. And that's also where the term Weibertheit comes from, that Weibertheit was translations of Jewish texts into Yiddish for women, Weiber meaning wives or women. So Yiddishism was about turning the impression of Yiddish from this mama lashon, this Weibertheit, this derided jargon into a quote unquote real language. Of course, there's what is a real language? I mean, a lot of people theorize this, but I think it was one of the Weinreichs, two different Yiddish scholars. I don't know if it was Max or Uriel, who said the language is a dialect with an army and a navy. The delegitimization of Yiddish is that it's not a quote-unquote real language because it's just a mix of German, Hebrew, and Russian. That's a real oversimplification of any language, and you could turn that on to many other languages in the world. But in comparison to Hebrew, which people think of as pure and unchanged, modern Hebrew, which is, of course, not true. Modern Hebrew is very much changed and is changing all the time. Yiddish is considered to be less than. So it's all of those different factors coming together.
Can you talk a little bit about how you see the appeal of Yiddish to, let's say, younger people today? Like, what's that about as you see it?
The reason I hesitate to answer is I think this is also oversimplified a lot of the time, even by people like me. I think a lot of people think it's just sort of anti-Zionist thing. I don't think that's primarily true. So I want to divide people who are into Yiddish into, let's say, two categories, even though there's a lot more of them. There are these quote-unquote Yiddishists who tend to learn Yiddish, speak Yiddish, and really are very devoted to using Yiddish in everyday life and speaking Yiddish with their children, perhaps. And then there are people who love Yiddish, don't necessarily speak it or speak it that well, but are very, very, very attached, but not necessarily from the same angle. That Yiddish can sort of be an object of their attention without being a medium through which they are able to interpret the world. The Yiddishists I know, the ones who really go very far with the language, don't totally fit into the stereotypes of, like, sort of just left-wing, anti-Zionist, countercultural Jews. There are a lot of those in that category, but there's also a lot of people who are interested in language more broadly or came into Yiddish for some intangible reason or sort of just like an accident of fate. What's really great about that world, one of the things that I wish could be carried over into the Jewish world more generally, is that because of the love for Yiddish that we have, a lot of the things that make us different can fall to the side. You can be friends Zionist and not Zionist. You can be friends Orthodox and secular, even Hasidic, right? And then the other community, the other side of it, the people who speak some Yiddish or not so much Yiddish, but love Yiddish and really care about it. And I don't want to sound dismissive to these people. It's a real devotion that they have. Those are often more kind of secular left-wing folks who are kind of finding Yiddish as a path towards Jewish identity. Both groups are doing that. They're just doing it in two different ways. So I think it's hard to say what attracts all of these people to it, because I think it is often intangible. It's sort of like, how do you fall in love with a person? I don't know. It's like, you know, it's about timing and it's about all sorts of different things. But I can just say for me that at the particular time that I got into Yiddish, I had just kind of gotten out of that Israel studies world, and my whole entire Jewish identity for many, many years was wrapped up in Zionism. That was no longer a satisfying path towards Judaism for me. And I think Yiddish just kind of hit at the right time. It just like tugged at my heartstrings at the right time in my young life. And at the same time, continue to have a relationship with Israel. I'm actually marrying an Israeli and still am there a lot of the time. So in terms of Yiddish being my pathway out of that, it didn't end up being because of, again, accidents of life.
Do you imagine that there ought to be kind of a vision for the future? I'm thinking about, like, for example, Latin. You know, many of us take Latin in school and really love it, but, you know, and certain people love it more than others. And the way that manifests is that there are these Latin conventions and, you know, there's something going on in Latin, but there isn't necessarily a vision that, you know, we're going to all start speaking Latin or even some substantial number of people should start speaking Latin. And it feels to me like the viewpoint about Yiddish is different from that. It's not only the joy of a language in which much of Jewish culture, you know, for 1,000 years or more was the main way Jewish culture was manifested. And even if nobody were ever to speak Yiddish as a living language again, I desperately want that material to be brought into other languages, whether it's Hebrew or English or whatever. And yet at the same time, it seems like it's more than that as well. And I would love to kind of explore, like, as you see it, as you hope, as you think others hope, like, what is a vision for where this might all be going or where it could go in terms of a future for Yiddish?
Yeah, you're right. There are Yiddishists who really want this to go beyond sort of just translating text or a few people having access to these pearls of Jewish culture. But like, here's an example that's going on right now. There are two people who grew up in the Hasidic world working on Duolingo for Yiddish with the granddaughter of Mordechai Schechter. Her name is Mina Lifsha. Yiddish Duolingo, unlike Duolingo for almost any other language, has the potential to make an insane impact on the Yiddish world. So if I think about like what Yiddish Farm's done, and it's on a tiny farm and it has a capacity of like maybe 20 people can be there at once, how many Yiddish speakers that's added over the last couple of years to the world of people who not just learn Yiddish, not just to do research, but really want to like live in it, that's had a massive impact. The potential of Duolingo is kind of mind-blowing. So that's an example of, you know, Mina Lifsha, who speaks Yiddish with her own children and in her own family, doing something to expand it beyond her household or beyond the Yiddish week. So you're definitely right. We're very passionate people, and we're not necessarily the most practical, because the most practical thing would be to say, okay, let's just let it go. You know, English is fine. It's going to be very hard to raise kids in Yiddish. There's so many barriers in our way. Let's just not do it. But we're not necessarily normal people. And that's for the best. I mean, the future, it looks bright right now. What I get worried about is Yiddish is cool right now, but I don't really want it to be cool, because cool is inherently not permanent. So I'm less interested in Yiddish coolness and the people who just think are like, Yiddish is cool. I want to learn it. Great. Go learn it. And that, like, you know, it's not a snobbery thing, but it's just, and like, we're not all cool. Like, I wouldn't say that that's the primary word I would use to describe the people of the Yiddish week. Like, we're very earnest and sweet and academic and weird.
Our last unit of episodes before we got into this one, where we're looking at Yiddish, was about Jewish education. And so parts of me are still floating in that universe. And I'm thinking about the fact that we just, without even thinking about it, when we talk about most synagogue Sunday schools, we call them Hebrew schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, and I certainly, when I use the phrase Hebrew school, I'm not even thinking about the Hebrew. It's just like, oh, the term that you use to refer to kids going to synagogue to learn about Jewish stuff on usually on a Sunday.
Right.
But that reflects a lot of things. It reflects that ultimately, for whatever set of reasons, many Sunday schools, I don't want to say all, but certainly a lot of them, eventually have chosen to center Hebrew as like really something you have to emerge from youth being familiar with. But Yiddish has not, I was never introduced to word one of Yiddish in Sunday school. And so I bring that up, and I don't really know what to do with that. I'm curious what you would help us think about there, because on the one hand, my response is like, that's silly. Like, there's all sorts of ways in which Yiddish, like Dan said, is a holder of so much Jewish history and contemporary culture. Then as I say it, I think to myself, like, practically, if we were to start focusing on Yiddish, would we also need to focus on Ladino? Would we also need to focus on Judeo-Arabic? Mm-hmm. Would we also, like, how would we do that in a way that's not, to use a term that is both used and criticized a great deal today, Ashkenormative? Like, how do we practically do that? And so on the one hand, I'm asking that literal question about education, because I think how we educate about this is important. But I'm also thinking more generally, just because I'm like a person and I talk to people who it's like, I do have a little bit of that impulse in me that's like, oh, I kind of want to relate to Yiddish. Like, I know my great grandparents, it was their native language. I know for even my own mom, she grew up not fluent, but knowing, it feels important to me.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I think about the grand scheme of choices I could make and things I could learn about Jewishly, it feels like I'm choosing something that is not a universal kind of Jewish thing. It's present in a lot of our histories. A large percentage of American Jews trace to places that spoke Yiddish. But like, how should schools wrestle with these questions of Ashkenormativity, of education, et cetera?
Oh gosh. Okay. So the first question, I think my best answer is that probably the term Hebrew school was partly to plaster over the fact that there's very little talk about spirituality in Hebrew school. That's my impression of it, is, you know, focus on the Hebrew instead of on the God stuff. That you can take that or leave that, but I don't have a great answer for that. In American Jewish history, there was a lot of use of the term Hebrew or Israelite also to sort of frame the Jews in the country as something different than the Jews of Europe, or to focus on them as sort of a national group that could be absorbed into America. So I think there are a bunch of reasons why it's called Hebrew school. In terms of the Ashkenormativity aspect, I've done a couple talks about this, and I think about it a lot, especially in my teaching. For me, learning Yiddish has only yielded more interest in other diasporic Jewish cultures. I wouldn't say that when my focus was on Israel, I felt interested in anything about the diaspora, Yiddish or Ladino or Judeo-Arabic, nothing. So for me, it's only yielded more interest and has made me a more sensitive person as an educator about integrating non-Ashkenazi histories into my curriculum. So my answer to people who, and I've talked to a lot of people in your position who say, I kind of want to learn Yiddish, but maybe it doesn't feel great, or should I be learning Arabic? All of that is good. But I think, you know, anyone who's learned anything before knows that it's better when you have personal motivation and excitement about a subject. So if Yiddish is the thing that excites you, I don't think that Ashkenormativity should be a good reason not to learn it. I think that learning about one diaspora culture opens up other worlds. The only people I know, honestly, who speak Ladino, and this is just in my tiny world, are people who also speak Yiddish. Meaning, like, language yields interest in more language. Polyglots are a thing. So I don't think there's only room in the world for one Jewish language on top of Hebrew, or that Hebrew even has to be the only Jewish language people know.
I had a reaction to, there was some kind of statement that was put out by the head of the Jewish agency in Israel, Herzog, and he was going to start this big initiative that all Jews across the world should learn Hebrew so that we would have a common language. And my reaction to that was, we already do have a common language, English.
Yeah.
That all Jews in the world, not all, of course, but the vast majority of Jews in the world speak English better today than they're likely to ever speak Hebrew, no matter how much of an initiative the Jewish Agency undertakes. And the question, in a way, is, why is that bad? In other words, that a huge amount of Jewish cultural productivity from a few thousand years ago or a couple thousand years ago was in Aramaic, perhaps a Judaic form of Aramaic, but Aramaic was basically the English of its day. And so it's, what's weird to me is that when people look at Aramaic today and imagine it to be some kind of Jewish language, it's actually like if English was lost and then a thousand years from now, people uncovered all these Jewish books written in English and said, wow, this was a Jewish language of English, you know? And so I guess then I wonder, like, well, what's the importance of an actual Jewish language, right? Or a more confirmed Jewish language like Yiddish? And you know, other than, I guess, the joy of it, which I don't discount. I think that that's important in its own right. And like you said, it's for those who take great joy in it, like anything in which people take great joy, it's a wonderful thing. But as we think about why, you know, make the case for it, and I know you're not there to make the case for it, but if we were to make the case for it, you know, what is it that is the advantage of kind of learning, or even, you know, something like you're saying that people are raising their kids in Yiddish, like, what is the value of doing that as a sort of ongoing project, other than for the individual's own joy?
I don't think there's anything practical about it. I've said that before. I'll say it again. Obviously, English is more practical. And I think that there isn't a concrete reason that I can blanket over. I think that it is primarily emotional, and it's about the feeling one has when speaking one of these Jewish languages or any language that someone connects to. The only argument I can make beyond sort of just people do it because they want to do it and that's valid is, you know, having access to reading these works of literature, being able to listen to Yiddish song and know what they're saying, going to Yiddish theater, it can add, you know, value to your life and create another path towards feeling, behaving and acting and performing your Judaism. And giving that to your kids also seems like a gift. I mean, we all just know also bilingualism is good for kids. And if you want to do it in any language, that's great. Yiddish is one that they can't go to a country and learn themselves. So, you know, Hebrew is important for a lot of Jews, but there's Israel to go to and to learn in and to learn from all of its cultural production. Yiddish doesn't have that. So when you do it with a kid, you're really giving them something that it's not going to be easy for them to get anywhere else.
So let's maybe transition to the realm of academia. You're involved with a publication called In Geveb. Could you tell us a little bit about that and who's writing in it and what are they writing about?
So on one foot, In Geveb is a Yiddish studies journal that's entirely digital, established by a group of PhD candidates and I think recent grads, along with Professor David Raskies and a few others, to fill a gap that there was in terms of there was kind of no home at that time or very few places to publish about Yiddish topics, about Yiddish literature primarily, and they wanted to do it entirely online at a time where that was still not really considered as legitimate publishing. I think it's becoming more and more legitimate with time. What's great about In Geveb is that they're also very public-facing, so they have the peer review section, but also they have a blog that posts just awesome, interesting things about Yiddish in culture, in literature, in history. And my particular agenda sort of in Yiddish studies is it's more about actually like using Yiddish in American Jewish history, not just as, again, sort of the medium, right? A lot of American Jewish historians can read Yiddish so they can understand sources, but Yiddish is not often the subject of American Jewish historical research. And my role in Geveb, or in sort of the Yiddish studies world, is to be writing about Yiddishists, about Yiddish speakers in American Jewish history. And I also sort of do enter the contemporary realm to an extent because my work is about the post-war period and I've leaned a little bit closer to the contemporary moment in some of my work on Yiddish specifically.
On the one hand, you have all this sensational work looking at Yiddish in American Jewish history, like you've spoken about. And there's also the set of interests that you have looking at summer camps. And there's a little bit of a Venn diagram where Both of those collide is the sense I get. And so I'd love to go to that center of the Venn diagram and ask, and maybe this feels like sort of an out of nowhere thing to listeners because we haven't been talking about summer camp so much, but I think that there are some really interesting ways, interesting parallels that I think about in terms of language of summer camp, language of the literal language, Yiddish. But like when you look at Yiddish in American summer camp contexts, what have you found? What is some of the work that you've done?
So my dissertation and now a completed book manuscript, yay, very exciting, is about summer camps, Jewish summer camps in the post-war period, looking specifically at sort of the most ideological educational types. So that includes Zionist summer camps, Yiddish-focused or Yiddishist summer camps, the conservative movement camps, aka Ramah, and the reform movement camps. When I embarked on that project, actually a lot of people said, why don't you just do the Yiddish camps? But what I found in the field of, not a tiny field actually, of people who study American Jewish summer camping was a lot of looking at one type of camp and writing about it as if it's utterly unique. But when I looked in the archives, I found that actually they were all kind of doing the same thing, just applying their different ideological lenses to the situation, but using a lot of the same methods and organizing time and space the same way, all these different ways that sort of like the structure of camp life was the same across all the types. Looking at Yiddish alongside the camps I think most Jews know a lot more about, the Zionist camps and the conservative and reform camps, I was able to illuminate that if we were to only look at the Yiddish camps, people would say, well, this has nothing to do with the reform and conservative camps that are obviously more important. And if I only looked at them, I wouldn't understand actually the fascinating similarities and the ways in which camp educators, while they all had different kind of ideological lenses to apply to the situation, their goals or their visions of camps as having the power to kind of transform Jewish culture in a moment in which they perceived it as declining were the same. So that for me is kind of a good example of how when you look at Yiddish, you get shown another angle. Because actually these other camps, the reform and conservative camps become more and more Zionist, become more and more similar to the Zionist camps. But you have this alternative story. These camps also close. So it's not necessarily about the great success of the Yiddishists at proposing an alternative path towards Jewishness in the post-war period, but they do present that path. And I think that my most recent article in American Jewish History, which is about the ways in which those camps transformed Yiddishism from a national linguistic ideology into a path toward Jewish identity, they definitely succeeded in that, right? Like the quote-unquote Yiddish revival, and I put it in quotes because people talk about it all the time. Like it comes up every couple of years, like it's just a new thing. It's been going on for decades to the extent it exists at all. That is all because of the work that American Yiddishists did in the post-war period to transform Yiddish from what it was in Europe into something essentially American Jewish.
I really appreciate the way that you spoke about how, you know, individuals are called to certain interests and like follow those. And I do want to ask some like should questions. It's always dangerous with folks who are scholars to ask like should questions about the world, but like I'm going to do it. I kind of want to ask, if you're a communal organization, if you are a collective of some kind, there's a lot of wrestling that I actually think is mostly not happening. I don't think institutions are like spending their days thinking, how much Hebrew should we do? How much Yiddish? How much? Like, I don't think that's actually happening. I think for the most part, we're just sort of by default mostly operating in English and assuming that we have to teach Hebrew through B-Mitzvah. If you were, or maybe you are to some extent involved with such collective kinds of organizations, like what would you kind of say should, capital S-H, should be a kind of relationship to Yiddish? Because I look at it and I really don't have an answer. I don't know, but I feel certain that the answer is more than zero. And I feel that in most Jewish communal institutions I know of that are focused on whether it's building community, whether it's learning, whether it's educating, whether it's spirituality, I feel like Yiddish is not getting much bandwidth, airtime, whatever metaphor. So what would you say should be a kind of orientation? And with of course, the caveat that different institutions will choose different kinds of amounts.
You're definitely right that academics are very reticent to answer these sorts of questions, but I'll try. So in November, I was at Brandeis at a conference called The Power of Jewish Camps. And it was a research conference, but it mixed scholars with practitioners. So you had people from the Foundation for Jewish Camp and camp directors there from different movements. And I gave a paper about what I call the Israelification of American Jewish summer camping, talking about sort of the sameness that occurred with Reform and conservative camping alongside Zionist camps, using camps as a way of sort of simulating what they understood to be a more authentic Jewish life over there in Israel, in order to transform kids here into sort of less suburban, comfortable, affluent post-war Jews. At the end of that talk, I looped in If Not Now, because I thought it was really important that this group talked about If Not Now and their hashtag You Never Told Me campaign, which basically is, you know, If Not Now is this anti-occupation movement here in America. And their campaign is all about kind of questioning the leaders of their youth movements, summer camps, Hebrew schools. Why didn't they tell them about the occupation? Why didn't they tell them about Palestinians? So I kind of, at the end of the talk, brought them in and suggested that not only are they posing a challenge to camps to talk, have those political conversations, but perhaps also posing the challenge of how do we expand Jewish education to be not only about Israel, so extremely about Israel. And then, you know, some people said, oh, well, it's not, right? Like they learn about Judaism too. I said, absolutely. But the culture part, the songs they sing and the dances they dance and the ways that camps structure their time, even historically speaking, at least, we're kind of simulating like ideas of how Israelis lived or how the kibbutz function. And that's embedded into camp. That's not just about the individual activity or pula that happens at camp. That's about how it's structured. And then afterward, there was a conversation about Israel education led by practitioners and researchers of Israel education. And a young woman who I think is a master's student at Brandeis raised her hand and said, I don't understand what would camp look like without Israel? What would that even be? And I thought, wow, that's how deeply ingrained this is, that people can't even imagine what Jewish education is without Israel. I that's not to judge the woman who said that. I felt the same way when I was about her age, actually. So my suggestion to people in Jewish communal life and in Jewish education, it's not really just about Yiddish, right? I think it's important that all different parts of diaspora history and culture are told. And how much bandwidth, that really depends on also the ability of educators to talk about it. I think one issue is, you know, everyone is perpetuating the things they learned about at school and camp, and they're not prepared necessarily to teach in detail about those subjects. But I think it's a worthy cause, and I hope there'll be more of it, because I think otherwise Jewish educators are going to just have a continued problem of alumni and camp counselors and high school students saying they're not satisfied. Obviously, what needs to happen is something more grand or larger scale, where there's something created for educators that they can use. Because I understand how tiring it is to be a teacher and how hard it is to make new curricula, especially about stuff you just don't know that much about. And also American Jewish history, which doesn't get a lot of airtime. Why did I have to get to graduate school to realize that American Jews, aka my history, exists? That, you know, that's crazy.
So I feel like in some ways what you're talking about is making me think about both the over-inclusivity and the under-inclusivity of Jewish education, in the sense that I've had similar comments, I think on the podcast and certainly elsewhere in my life, to what you said about Israel at camp. You know, that's kind of what I've said about teaching Hebrew in Hebrew school, right? Like I've said, you know, imagine how much more Judaism we could teach if we didn't spend so much time teaching Hebrew, which nobody ever really learns very well anyway. Mm-hmm. Now you could say, well, that's not our goal, for them to learn it well. Our goal, you know, okay, fine. But I mean, just imagine the possibility. And most people can't even imagine, you know, it's like they don't even want to imagine.
And how much less kids would dread it, maybe.
And so like one thing is that the thing, you know, in particular, learning Hebrew in a certain way. And by the way, I think there's some interesting connection here with why and how we might learn Yiddish, because the way that we're teaching Hebrew in Hebrew school, people talk about, you know, oh, well, yeah, we're going to be able to communicate with Israelis in Hebrew. Well, number one, rarely does anybody learn Hebrew well enough to actually communicate with an Israeli in Hebrew. And number two, the Israelis immediately start talking to you in English because they don't want to listen to your terrible, you know, Hebrew. So it seems like it's not very functional there. And then in terms of the prayers, okay, you know, so yes, there's a little bit of advantage to it. But again, the question is, when we have limited time, what's the cost benefit? So on the one hand, we're focused very much on this one thing, which may not need to be a part of it. And the other is that, you know, partly because of that, we're not including everything else. And it may not be because of a nefarious purpose. It may just be like we ran out of time, right?
Yeah. One class or one Pulat camp about Yiddish is a form of planting a seed that can last forever. I mean, I remember a couple things I learned at camp that sparked interest in things that I would do later. It doesn't have to take much to just make sure that other themes get included. I just remember, for example, at my camp, Camp Tel Yehuda in 2002, I did a program called Alumim, and that's supposed to be the Jewish history program. It's like setting the stage for the rest of what's going to happen over the course of your time at Tel Yehuda, which is the senior camp of Young Judea, the movement. And Jewish history was taught just as ancient Israel, persecution, Holocaust, yay, Israel's been created. And this is such a stereotype, it's such a trope, but it's true, that is how it's often taught. So it's really basic to just make sure, if you're a Jewish educator, that you're thinking beyond that narrative, which is just so easy to rely to kind of fall back on, because narratives seem nice for children. But I think children, we should give them more credit than that. They don't need you to narrativize history entirely, that it can be sort of chaotic and not just leading up to some sort of climactic moment that we can say, okay, well, that was terrible, but at least we have Israel now. So I don't think it has to be much, honestly.
I think with Yiddish learning and with any language learning, so frequently the conversation is about fluency, which makes an abundant amount of sense, because people often are learning languages or acquainting with languages for the purpose of, you know, talking to people that speak that language. And I guess I'm reflecting on my own relationship to Hebrew in this conversation. So I'm proving your point about how thinking about Yiddish is not just about Yiddish. It causes us to then think about other languages too. Like, absolutely. But like, I'm thinking about my own relationship with Hebrew, which is extensive. I'm able to read a great deal in Hebrew, but I'm one notch or two notches below fluent. When I watch Israeli television shows, I either have to slow it down or I have to like pause a bunch and watch multiple times. Like I can sort of, but I say that actually not because I have some deep desire in me to get those last couple notches. I think there's actually something really beautiful. Like I think when I relate to Hebrew, it is kind of as an outsider, and it makes me see things. Like I hear how things in Hebrew sound like English, because like I'm not really fully on Hebrew's turf. I'm still like in my own world. So I like notice puns where like a Hebrew word will sound like English. And then people who listen to the podcast will hear me rant and rave about them. And I say rant and rave, but I actually think there's like a deep meaning to that. And so I guess I'm curious, like, one of my takeaways from this conversation is like, I actually do desire that with you. Like, I don't need to go and learn. Like, I think so often we frame this as either you have to spend years learning the language so that you can like speak Yiddish and listen to wonderful podcasts like Vibertyche, which I do hope some people will do. But like, what would you say to somebody who's listening? And, you know, maybe that isn't realistic for whatever reason with Yiddish, but there might be a level or two that they could achieve where, you know, you at least have a relationship with this language that is more than the few words that you heard either from a grandparent or from a Jewish institution. What I'm getting at is I think there's actually like a really beautiful, deep relationship to a language specifically, uniquely, that comes when you are in this in-between status where you don't actually speak it fully. Dan and I sometimes talk about this because Dan is a fluent Hebrew speaker and literally has translated books in Hebrew. And Dan will find lots and lots in Hebrew that I will not. But like, there's some moments where I'll notice a pun or something. I'll like hear something funny that's funny to me. But like to Dan, he's in the language, so he doesn't hear that. So I guess what I'm asking it is like, do you experience that with Yiddish, or do you know folks that do? Or like, what can we learn? What can we think about specifically from a place where you're actually not fluent in a language, where it's not your native tongue, but where from a Jewish lens, you are relating to it on an interesting, meaningful level, despite or because of that?
Yeah, I think when you're not fluent, you don't take for granted kind of what you're saying. You see the exciting elements of the language because you're learning it for the first time and you're able to make those connections from the outside. Like if I were to ask my fiance, you know, hey, what are the new slang things in Hebrew that actually are direct translations of something in English? He's a fluent English speaker. He wouldn't necessarily be able to tell me. He doesn't think about language from the perspective of a learner. He's thinking about it as native in both languages. And to him, they're just kind of like fully integrated. There's no space between them. He can't look at Hebrew and say, oh, this is a calque, which is like sort of the direct translation thing from English. And so when you're learning a language or when you're in that in-between phase, it is so exciting, and you feel invigorated, I think, in that particular stage, whereas later you can take kind of for granted what you already know.
So we've covered a lot of territory. What's that closing intention? What's that closing message that you'd love to leave listeners with as they go from the driver's seat of their car where they're listening to the podcast to whatever's next in the flow of their day?
I can obviously say it would be great if you wanted to learn Yiddish. That's great. We'll welcome you with open arms. But I think even more so that it's okay to follow passions that are not practical. I think a lot of people I encounter just say, well, why would you create a podcast in Yiddish? So few people can speak it. I mean, first of all, if I've said anything today, I've proven that that's not totally true. But you don't always have to do something because it's going to bring, you know, obvious sort of statistical results, but rather because you want to and because you care about something and that things that are, you know, that serve small populations are still valid. So even if your interest after this conversation has nothing to do with Yiddish, I think it's great to not be afraid to pursue interests that are a bit off the beaten path or might seem impractical.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you. It's been great.
And thank you so much to all of you out there listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. We hope you've enjoyed this journey thus far through our unit on Yiddish. And as a reminder, we hope that you will support our Kickstarter, judaismunbound.com/book. That's the spot where you can support our Kickstarter campaign to make Judaism Unbound Bound a reality. We hope that you'll head there. As a last note in this episode, we want to close it out in the way that we always do by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to our Twitter feed at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.